All right, let's start with Tuesday.
Let's talk about the problem I gave you on Tuesday. Who's got an answer?
Perhaps the mutation could revert or be leaky.
Okay, what was the question?
Something like a mutant can be made that does not make formal groups and this bacteria survives.
Okay. And the answer is?
The mutation could revert or be leaky.
It could revert. Then it's not the mutation. It's not a mutation.
Okay. Well, but it could have occurred and then gone back.
So then we have to look at the same thing.
Okay.
And the mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Not a second event.
All
right. Okay, it could be a leaky, right? I'll accept that, right? One of the things you have to understand about genetics is that it sometimes is not an all baby, right?
Yeah.
Welcome back. What happened to you, Steve?
Well, it's traveling.
You're traveling back from?
Vegas.
From Vegas. This is before us?
For a long weekend.
For a long weekend. So there's a death in the family. There's a marriage that was planned 6 years ago. This was just a fun time for you to take off the most ready?
Yeah.
Okay. First responsibility, your graduate students, is that correct? Where are your commitments? I'm not just talking about Dave, I'm talking about every one of you now, right? Where are your commitments? It's a rhetorical question. Answer it in your own mind. Is it to my education? Is it to my becoming a professional in this particular career track? Or is there something else that's pulling at your time? Right? You got to be committed to this. Otherwise, you find something else to do in your career. This is not something that's easy to do. I'm not just talking about this course. I'm talking about getting a PhD. Right? I don't want to have to say that again. Just be sure you understand what you got yourself into and that your commitment will expect for everyone. Now, mutations. How do you get a mutation that's going to let this organism be able to survive? Could be leaky, and that's fine, because sometimes they're not all or none. Other possibilities, tell me. Andrew, your idea, you want to take that?
A leaky mutation, I believe, is a mutation that occurs but then doesn't prevent the cell from acting like it would have without the mutation.
That's kind of fuzzy. Does that satisfy you?
So it's not
a mutation, but the gene product still retains some activity.
Much better explanation. Right. I think you're on the right track, but one's explanation is correct. You have something else?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just the rest of your hand. Okay, so it could be leaky, and that's why you're able to get something to survive, some bacteria to survive.
Yeah.
It could be 10% of mutation, right? So in the certain conditions, you'll be able to grow. In other conditions, it'll be beautiful.
Could a second mutation encode an enzyme with a similar function?
A second mutation. We're not talking about second mutation. We're talking about a single. Okay. Yeah.
Can you also get the mutation so that this enzyme removes the methyl cap? Can you get a mutation so that the bacteria can survive? Does it need that methyl cap for function?
Does it need a methyl cap for function? That's a good question.
So I think you can actually have some bacteria that they don't grow as well, but they can still survive.
Okay, good. Okay, so we're talking about the formula and the thiamine at the internal level, right? Is that really required? And the answer is no, it's not required. So taking that then, where do you want to go with this?
You can make a double mutant and get rid of the environment that actually puts the formula under.
Right. So if you got a mutation in the enzyme that puts a formal group on the methionine, then you don't need the enzyme that removes that formal group from the methionine. So that's one way to overcome that particular otherwise lethal mutation. Okay? So that's a type of suppressor. We won't be talking about that today when we talk about mutations. Okay, that's good. Good job. All right, so why do we even bother talking about mutants? And the reason is because they're really important, and particularly with bacteria, because for a geneticist, the approach and the strategy that a geneticist uses is to look for mutants that particular that affect biological functions. So any kind of a scientist is always asking a question about something. In life scientists will ask about biological functions, and for a geneticist, our approach is to start with the premise that genetics is necessary to show that a biochemical finding is relevant, that has reality in a living cell, and where that particular reality is placed within that cell. So if you think about biology in the great scheme of the physical sciences and the life sciences, it's at the top of the pyramid, which is why, in principle, I would expect that secondary education covers physics, chemistry, and then biology. Because biology requires those others. And underlying all of the science topics is mathematics. So you get your math, you get your physics, you get your chemistry, then you get your biology, because biology needs all the other ones. And for a biologist who is a geneticist, the approach that we use is to establish a link between the in vivo and in vitro phenomenon by having mutants. And mutants are those particular variants that are affected in one of those biological processes. So we can make the link between what's observed in vitro, biochemical approach, and in vivo. So the importance of mutant analysis is that genetic markers help us to map genes that are important for function, or for a particular protein that you're interested in. Mutant analysis helps us to define enzymatic steps in the biosynthetic pathway. So if you're looking at the processes to go from compound A to compound X, for example, mutants will help you to define how many steps there are in that pathway, because you should be able to get mutations in each of those genes which provide the different enzymes in the pathway for synthesis of that compound. Mutations and mutants help us to characterize new biosynthetic and regulatory systems. So not every living organism has found the same solution to a similar problem. So the pathway for synthesis of certain compounds, even amino acids, don't necessarily follow the same paths in different organisms. So having mutants in different organisms in these particular biosynthetic pathways helps us to characterize the way the different organisms have evolved the different enzymes required to go from A to F. Mutants help us to do fine structure analysis of operons, and operons, as you all know, are groups of genes, linked genes, which are going to be expressed in a simultaneous or coordinated fashion. Protein structure analysis can be done most effectively by having mutants, which are altered in the amino acid composition of the protein, so that you can look at structure-function relationships. It's the first thing that you do if you're given a project to determine how the different amino acids alter function based on how they contribute to the structure of the protein. For enzymes, for example, you would be looking for the enzymatic, the active site of the enzyme. There's going to be some protein structure within that enzyme, and thus you can isolate mutants with altered protein structures, altered amino acids that are altered in their amino acids, and thus altered in protein enzyme activity. And then finally, at the biotechnology end of the spectrum, strain construction for overexpressing of proteins, for making derivatives of bacteria that are easier to manipulate genetically, for other genetic analysis. All of this involves knowing genetics and isolated mutants, which can contribute to strains that now are much more adaptive for your own particular processes. This is very important in the biotechnology industry, chemical industry, fermentation industry, and in fact has been done for over a century using spontaneous mutants and selecting for variants which are better at doing the things that you need for these particular industrial processes. Now we can take a more directed approach in isolating specific directed mutants because we have a better understanding of the pathways and also have the genetic tools for doing these modifications. So why are we talking about doing genetics with bacteria? What are the advantages of working with bacteria? I think it's pretty simple and straightforward. If you look at this list, which is just a brief list of the different advantages you have when you work with bacteria, First of all, they're haploid organisms, so it's easy to do genetics when you're looking at a single copy of genes. You're not worried about looking at diploid organisms. The short generation time leads to the ability to generate massive numbers of a population, and thus, when you're looking for rare events within that population, having a short generation time, as you have with bacterial cultures, enables you to isolate mutants very easily, because you can generate large numbers in the population and look for those rare events very easily. They reproduce asexually, so you don't have to worry about mating pairs. When you're growing them up in this short generation time, means that a single organism divides and becomes two, and then you have two go to four, and that's what we define as exponential growth. And this is growth and reproduction is done in the absence of DNA exchange. There's no sexual exchange necessary for this rapid generation time. For the most part, the bacteria that we're going to be talking about grow easily on artificial medium, so they form colonies, so you can actually see the growth of a colony, which represents the growth from a single organism that was plated on that plate. These can be purified, you can make sure of evolutions of large numbers of populations, you can apply selective pressure so that you can select for variants within the population. Bacteria are easily stored either by freeze drying or by freezing down at minus 20 or minus 80 degrees, and they have genetic exchange, horizontal gene transfer in bacteria by conjugation, transfer of DNA by direct contact between bacteria, by transduction, phage-mediated transfer, and by transformation, just DNA transfer mediated by native DNA. So what are the particular principles that are involved in doing genetic analysis of bacteria? First of all, if you want to do an analysis of a particular organism, you need to be able to generate and select mutants. Now, all of these steps obviously have been well developed and worked out for E. coli, but there'll be some organisms that you may run across that you may even be studying that don't have one or more of these steps. So the first step is you need to be able to generate and select mutants. If you want to do genetics, you have to have mutants. You need to be able to introduce DNA back into these bacteria. So you need a way either for transforming them or by conjugation or using phage to reintroduce DNA into the bacterial cells. And you have to have some way for selecting and characterizing the mutants for the recombinants. This assumes that you have a way of growing the organism in artificial medium. Otherwise, you can't satisfy this requirement. Or it's going to be difficult to satisfy this requirement, you need to have some other way to be able to detect and to be able to purify and characterize those variants. And the easiest way, obviously, is using artificial medium, growing them on as colonies on petri dishes. So these are some of the requirements that you need to do genetics in bacteria. Now, the basic definitions we went over in the previous class, the allele descriptions we went over before as well, and let's get right into mutants and mutations. Some of this stuff is going to be reviewed from MedMicro, so I'm going to go over it and assume that you reviewed it already, so we'll just go over it kind of briefly. So mutations basically are changes in your DNA sequence. Now again, I'm going to restrict my discussion to bacteria. So don't be thinking, well, you know, this will include viruses, which are RNA-based, or phages, which are RNA-based. I'm just talking about bacteria here, okay? So mutations are changes in your DNA sequence. They can involve either base substitutions or genetic rearrangements. And the base substitutions are transitions or transversions, changing a single base pair within the DNA structure or rearranging the DNA altogether. And in terms of the genetic rearrangements that can occur, the different types are deletions, where you remove one or more bases from the DNA, duplications, where you have repeats of a stretch of DNA, insertions, where you have an insertion of a stretch of DNA within the genome of the organism, or inversions, where a stretch of DNA is actually inverted, so that you have now inverted repeats of a region, or you have just a piece of DNA that's been flipped over within the genome. Some of these types of rearrangements that I've listed here actually occur on purpose. That is, they're genetically programmed within the bacteria. So a couple of examples that you're probably familiar with are Neisseria gonorrhea and you're all familiar with, or at least have heard about, the pillars and the opacity genes in the Neisseria gonorrhea. Those of you who took med micro or the pathogenic microbiology part know about these genes being genes which are required for virulence, and they also are genes which vary, energetically speaking, within the organism. And the way that they vary is that the genes themselves are programmed to be turned on or turned off. And that programming is defined by gene rearrangements within the organism. Similarly, the expression of the flagella genes in Salmonella typhimurium are turned on and off by gene rearrangement, an inversion of a piece of DNA that's involved in the expression of the flagella genes. And something that you all have not probably been exposed to at some point is the generation of diversity within immunoglobulins in mammalian organisms. This is based on genetically programmed rearrangements of genes, how you make the different pieces of DNA that are going to express immunoglobulins from IgM to IgG to IgA involves genetically programmed gene rearrangements. So this is not something which is only discussed in the context of mutation events. It's also something which has been adapted as a way of genetic regulation of gene expression in bacteria and higher organisms, and also a way of deliberately generating diversity in a population of molecules by having the ability to scramble, basically, these genes and to reassemble them. Yeah?
We can see one type of genetic rearrangement
in gonorrhea. In gonorrhea, depending on whether you're looking at the pillars or opacity genes, you have basically a region of the genome in Neisseria which has an expression site for expression of the genes, and then cassettes distributed throughout the genome which has the structural gene. And when those structural genes recombine into the expression site, that's when that particular variant of that molecule is expressed. So you have gene rearrangements which lead to regulation of gene expression. And in the case of the flagella genes for Salmonella, what we see here is production of a protein which is involved in regulation of the gene organization here. And this H2 is the H2 flagellin. It can be turned on and turned off based on where this promoter is pointed. So when this promoter is flipped in the opposite direction because this piece of DNA is flipped or inverted, then you get you have no expression of the H2 flagellin gene because the promoter is no longer pointed in the right direction. You get expression of the hint protein from this promoter. So this is one way you get what we call phase variation in Salmonella, where you get turning on or off of the expression of the H2 flagellin protein. So again, it's a programmed gene rearrangement. In this case, it's an inversion, which dictates whether this gene is going to be expressed or not. Now, let's go back to the types of mutations. And again, this is a review of what you heard in MedMicro. The types of mutation can be manifested in several different fashions. So if you look at a single triplet codon, CGA, you can get silent mutations, which involve a single base change, which is in a, in this case, the third position, so that now instead of getting a different amino acid being encoded by this codon, it is still encoding the same amino acid. So this is what we call a degenerate mutation, in that even though the DNA has been altered, it doesn't lead to an alteration in phenotype. Because of the degeneracy of the code, this still encodes insertion of an arginine amino acid. So it's a silent mutation. Genotypically, it's mutated. Phenotypically, you won't see the difference. Similarly, if the base change alters the codon to glutamate, you get what we call a missense mutation. So there's a different amino acid being inserted here. But in this case, the altered polypeptide still maintains activity. So phenotypically, if you're just looking at the gross phenotype, the expression of this protein, you would say that there is no alteration in the mutation. But genotypically, it's altered. And in fact, if you sequence the protein, looked at the protein sequence, you would see there's a phenotypic difference in that there's not an arginine at this position, there's a different amino acid. But at a different level of phenotype, it would be neutral because the protein itself maintains activity.
So then another example of a missense mutation would be one where the difference in the base alters the codon so that you now have insertion of an amino acid which is not tolerated in terms of activity of the protein. And this would be manifested as an inactive protein, so we'd see a mutant phenotype. So both of these are missense mutations at the level of the protein itself, but the phenotypes would be different. Because in one case, the phenotype is preserved because it's a neutral mutation. In the other case, the phenotype is altered because it's a missense mutation that actually alters protein activity. And then finally, the last example here is an amino acid change, or a base change, which alters the codon from a sense codon to a nonsense codon, or a stop codon. In that case, you have production of a truncated polypeptide because translation would terminate at this codon rather than continue under normal circumstances. So this is just an example of the various types of amino acid changes that you would get if you took a single codon and changed the base at each of these three positions, to show you the variety of different amino acid outcomes that you get by having a single base change at any of these three positions within the UUA codon for leucine. And in several cases, you get stop codons. Now, if you go back and look at the genetic code in the front of your book and pick any of those codons, you can do the same experiment, and you can see that some of those codons will never generate a stop codon because you can't change it by single base change. So there are some codons which will yield nonsense mutations, and others which will never yield nonsense mutations, just change the single base within the codon. So you can just go through that exercise and prove that for yourself and see how the genetic code is somewhat limited in terms of the types of mutations you get if you just ask for a single base change in a triple codon. So those nonsense codons reflect the three different stop codons in bacteria, UAA, UAG, and UGA. These also sometimes are referred to as ochre, amber, and opal. And this is because when suppressor mutations were isolated, that we're able to suppress these particular stop codons, and we'll talk about suppressors in a moment, they were given these names. So that's just a nomenclature thing that you might run across in the readings. What you also need to be aware of, and we talked about this briefly in class on Tuesday, is the codon usage preferences of the organisms that you'll be working with. So these are the codons which are stop codons for bacteria, for E. coli. For some bacteria, one of these codons, UAG, for example, may encode a triplicate. So there will be some codon preferences or some divergence in the universal genetic code in some organisms. And as we saw on Tuesday, mitochondria also have a different language when it comes to stop codons. Some of these are not going to be recognized as stop codons, but will actually encode for amino acids. Now, let's talk about suppression. And I'm going to go into a little bit more depth than we went into in the MedMicro talking about suppression, because there are really more to it than what we just referred to in MedMicro. So suppression is any mutation that restores gene function without altering the original mutation. If you alter the original mutation, we can speak of those as reverts, because you just fixed what was wrong with it and made it back to wild type by changing the original mutation. Suppression is altering the gene function and restoring it in the presence of the original defect. So it doesn't change the original mutation. Intragenic suppressors are mutations at a second site within the gene that restores the gene function. So it's within the gene itself. And this can happen, for example, when we frame shift opposite sign at a second site, and that will restore the open reading effect. We saw that in MedMicro. I'll show you the slide to remind you about that. Or you can have a second site missense mutation that restores the conformation of the protein to its original state. Okay, so these are two different examples of how you can get a second mutation within a gene that will restore function of the gene. So let's look at that frameshift mutation. And again, if you have the insertion of a single base at this position, it puts the reading frame out of frame, so now you get the wrong amino acids being inserted, and thus the protein that's made will not have function. If you get a second mutation within that open reading frame, which deletes a base, then the two wrongs actually will lead to the restoration of the reopen reading frame so that now we're between those two mutation events, the insertion of a base and then the deletion of a base, the codons will not correspond to the original wild-type codons, but after this site, the reading frame is restored. So in principle, you can get an active protein if these four amino acids within the protein don't affect enzyme activity. So you now will get restoration of the reading frame, you'll get synthesis of the entire intact polypeptide, and if the activity, the enzymatic activity, can tolerate the wrong amino acids in this region, then you can restore activity. So in principle, this can work. In practice, it does. If you select for it, you'll get mutations that would be energetic suppressor mutations that can restore activity in exactly this fashion. Okay? Now, let's talk about estrogenic suppressors. And these are mutations in a second gene that restores gene function in the presence of the original mutated gene. And there are three classes of estrogenic suppressors that we can talk about. The informational one, conformational, and bypass suppressors. So we'll take these one at a time. The first one, which is the informational one, you've already heard of. This is your suppressor tRNA. So again, second estrogenic mutation. It's a mutation outside of the gene that's originally been mutated. So we call this an informational suppressor because it's the suppressor tRNA which is reading the sequence and being able to insert an amino acid at the stop codon. So here's your wild type protein, your wild type message, and your leucine tRNA is going to recognize the UUG and put in a leucine here. If you get an AMBR mutation, so that now the UUG is mutated to UAG, this is a stop codon. It's the AMBR stop codon. Under normal circumstances, the ribosomes read along here, and when they come to the UAG, translation will terminate. You get a truncated polypeptide. That is the nature of the mutation here, and you will have loss of activity. An AMBR suppressor mutation can arise in a tRNA, and in this case, it's a tyrosine tRNA, which has in its anticodon region a mutation such that now it no longer recognizes UAC for insertion of a tyrosine amino acid, right? But the suppressor mutation in the anticodon region of this tRNA changes it to a UAC, which will now recognize AUC, which will now recognize UAG, which is a stop codon. And here it will insert a tyrosine. Everyone follow?
No.
So this is a suppressor tRNA. The mutation is in the anticodon of the tRNA, so that now this tRNA no longer recognizes the normal codon for tyrosine, but recognizes a stop codon. Yes?
The real stop codon, whether it's the real stop codon we need is a UAG, then is there a possibility that the tyrosine is better instead?
That's a good question. So what happens in an organism? Well, what happens in a strain of E. coli that has this mutation, that now has an AMBR mutation or an AMBR suppressor, which is now capable of recognizing UAG as a stop codon and sticking tyrosine? I'll tell you that those organisms, those strains, are viable. It's not a lethal mutation. So what would you predict would happen in that organ, in that mutant?
You
would have
a
vein
of those, which
would be normal
to your
stop. Mm-hmm.
And so you might have some, where
there's
a stop code, you might insert something
for tyrosine. Why is that? So basically what you're saying is it's a numbers game, right?
Yeah.
Why would that be? You're right. It is a numbers game. But what's the reason for that? Is it? It's a tyrosine. Well, let's look at it. Here's the stop codon, UAG. Here's the normal codon for tyrosine. So you can mutate that by a single base change so that it will recognize this, right? How many other tRNAs are capable of undergoing the same mutational event and being able to recognize this particular AMBR stop? Right, you got 20 amino acids, you got, 60 codons? How many do we have in the genetic code? 61? 64? Give me a number, I'm guessing. 64, right, 64 codons, right? So how many of those can be mutated to recognize this? So you're right, it's a numbers game. Not all of them can do that, all right? So this particular species of suppressor tRNA is going to be a minor species. It's not going to be dominant in the population. So what's going to happen in a in the case of a normal stop codon at the end of a normal Mendelian frame is that it's going to be a race for the space. What's going to get there first? This suppressor tRNA that can recognize this stop codon, or the release factor that will terminate translation. Okay? So that's part of the game. The other part of it is that at the end of open reading frames, I don't know if we talked about this on Tuesday, but what do you find at the end of an open reading frame?
Termination sequence.
Which is what? Let's talk about for translation. So what do you find at the end? Well, that would affect transcription. Okay? So we're looking at the message now.
A stop codon?
You find a stop codon. What else do you find?
A loop or a
transcription? That's transcription. You find a stop codon, right? Say it again.
Yeah, we find a stop codon.
Say it again. Say it again.
Stop codon?
Sometimes, at the end of open reading frames, you find multiple stop codons. This bacteria don't want to screw things up. So if something like this happens, there'll be another stop codon, maybe another two or three codons down, to be sure that translation stops. Okay? So if you look at open reading frames, just based on the DNA that's dictated by the annotators, they're going to tell you where the stop codon is. If you look at the DNA sequence of the genome and go past that, you may find two or three other stop codons downstream, okay? So if you want to look at the whole neighborhood of that gene, now this is what you'll see in a lot of cases. Yeah?
Can you remember,
it depends. Sometimes they go a little bit less well, but for the most part, the mutations are tolerated pretty well. Because there are other tRNAs that will recognize this codon and put the tyrosine in there. Because there are multiple copies of tRNA. There's not just one tRNA for tyrosine that will recognize this codon. Because otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get this mutation, because then all the other polypeptides that require tyrosine in here because of this codon can't be translated. Right? So if there was just one copy of this tRNA in the genome, and you mutated that so that now it couldn't recognize this, but recognize stop, then recognizing the stop is not the main problem. The inability to put a tyrosine in here would be a problem, right? So there are multiple copies of tRNAs in an organism so that you've got lots of them being made, even if one of them is mutated, so it's now a suppressor tRNA. So that's the other way around the difficulty. Okay, so that's an example of one nonsense suppressor. Others are the ochre suppressors and the opal suppressors. And this just shows you the amino acids which are inserted at that position, because those are the tRNAs that are mutated. And again, if you look at the anticodons for these tRNAs, then you can see how they can be mutated such that they can now recognize the different stop codons in the organism. So you have tyrosine and tryptophan are the different kinds of tRNAs that can be mutated through suppressor tRNAs. Okay, so this is the question that Diana asked. Why isn't translation suppressed at all stop codons? Now we know the answer to that, right? If the tRNA tyrosine recognizes a stop codon, what happens at the normal tyrosine UAC? And we already answered that question too, because there are multiple copies of this species of tRNA. Not all of them are going to be mutated in the organism, so there will be other ones which can recognize that and put the tyrosine in. So you got the right questions and you got the right answers. That's great. Just good thinking. That's what I want to say. Now let's talk about a different type of suppressor. We talked about informational suppressors. Those are the tRNAs. These are conformational suppressors now. And this involves protein-protein interactions. So let's take the example here of a enzyme complex which involves interaction between two protein subunits, A and B. And this is the way they get together to form an active complex. If you have a mutation in A, which alters its conformation so that it can't interact with B, you have an inactive enzyme. Basically, the enzyme requires the contribution of both subunits. With the inability of A to interact with B, you get no activity, so the phenotype is a null phenotype. You can get a mutation now in subunit B, which is a suppressor mutation, second site, so it's not restoring the conformation of A, but it's altering B so that now it can interact with A. So that's a conformational mutation. It's a suppressor mutation. So it's in the second site, it's an estrogenic suppressor mutation that restores an active enzyme complex. This is pretty straightforward. Conceptually, I think it's pretty easy to understand. Okay? So two roles make a mark. All right. You can get A to interact with B if you have alterations which now allow them to be compatible, even though they are altered in their respective conformations. Now, let's talk about another type of mutation, which is a pathway suppressor. And the pathway suppressor requires us to look at the galactose utilization pathway. So galactose is utilized in E. coli by a process that involves three enzymes, Gal-K, Gal-T, and Gal-E. Gal-K has a phosphate group to galactose, and it's transported into the cell. UDP glucose is transferred to produce UDP galactose, and then Gal-E is an ephemerase which converts UDP galactose to UDP glucose. Now, what I'll tell you is that if you make a mutation in Gal-E, the organism becomes sensitive to galactose. So in the presence of galactose, these bugs will die. What you can do now is if you take and plate those Gal-E mutants and ask for them to grow in the presence of galactose, you will select for resistant mutants. And what you will find are mutants that have alterations in Gal-K, not in Gal-E. So intuitively, you would think that, well, if I'm going to be able to get resistant mutants that can now grow in the presence of galactose, they must be alterations of E or revertants of E that restore its activity, because it's a mutation in E that made them galactose sensitive in the first place. So how is it that those strains now actually have mutations in Gal-K and not Gal-E, which restores the ability to grow in galactose? Let's go back and look at the pathway. There's the pathway again. Original mutation is here. A pathway suppressor mutation is isolated here. Why is it that we got it? Pathway suppressor. What we did was we asked for the ability of this kind of a mutant to grow in the presence of galactose. And this is what we got. Gal-K mutants. Anybody? Nobody?
Is it just because the galactose can be converted to the second gate, not by the galactose process, it can go down the downstream?
You guys hear that back there? Jennifer, did you hear that? Say it again.
Since even though there's a mutation that UDP galactose can be converted to UDP glucose, the upstream Gal-K gene isn't converting the galactose to the second alpha D galactose monophosphate, so that product can't even be part of the problem in terms of the cell survival.
Do you get that?
Does that make sense?
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying, Roderick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What Roderick is saying is that if this mutation is causing galactose sensitivity, why is that? Now you gotta be thinking now. So it's because maybe this can't be processed? Maybe UDP galactose is bad for the cell? That's the case. Not only that, the accumulation of the galactose 1 phosphate is a little toxic for the bacteria as well. So if the accumulation of these compounds is the problem, if you knock out this gene, you don't make these compounds. There's no accumulation of the toxic products. because this can't process those toxic products. So we make a mutation in DLK, you can't generate those toxic products. Okay? So all that makes sense now if you start thinking about it. Now, if you think about it a little bit more, you should be able to get revertance of DLE, right? Because if you get revertance of DLE that can now restore polymerase activity, you can process this product to UDP glucose. That should solve the problem. It wouldn't be galactosensitive anymore. Right? You all agree with that? Just fix what's wrong with this. Get an intragenic suppression mutation, or get a point mutation that, not a point mutation, get a reversion of the original mutation. Now I'm going to tell you that that happens much less frequently than mutations in GALK. And you got to ask yourself, why is that? Why are mutants that are altered in GALK more frequently isolated in this selection than mutations that are revertants of GALE? Tony?
To make a mutation in GALK, you just have to change one thing, but anything can change from the mutation. But yeah, to revert back from the GALE to the wild type, you have to change the exact.
Exactly. Right. Perfect. You want to revert this back? One target. In GALK, anything in the entire looping reading frame is fair game if it will inactivate the enzyme. So you've got multiple possibilities of inactivating this much more readily than restoring this, fixing this, because here it's a very specific, very precise mutation that is required to restore or revert that mutation. For GALE, let's say that the GALE mutation is a single point mutation that inactivates the enzyme. Then to restore activity, you need to revert that single mutation back to the wild type. So it's very specific, very precise reversion. Whereas here, anything's fair game. Yeah, okay. So for GALE, for example, you have to revert by changing an A to a G. For GALK, pick one target, critical amino acid residue. Target any one of those three codons, any one of those three nucleotides of the codon, so that it doesn't put in the right amino acid, you're good to go. It's inactivated. And the pathway is inactivated. The bacteria grow. Okay? Just go with the puzzle.
No, I just thought you said, I just kind of remember what the hint
was, but you gave a specific name. Oh, for the reversion is just restoring the actual mutation to the wild type. Here we're talking about an extragenic suppressor, which is a pathway suppressor. So the mutation which restores function, okay, which is the ability to grow the presence of galactose, is in a second gene. And it's a gene that's involved in the pathway that gives you a way around the block. So if you look at those suppressors in context, what you have is informational suppressors, conformational, and bypass suppressors. The informational one is specific to the gene. I'm sorry, it's not specific to the gene. So if you have a suppressor tRNA, it can recognize a nonsense mutation in any gene that has that particular nonsense codon. It's specific for the allele. So it's only a particular tRNA that can be mutated to generate that suppressor. A conformational suppressor can happen in any gene. It can happen in any allele. Okay? So it's specific for the gene. A is interacting with B. If you have a mutation in A, then B has to be altered to change it. So that's specific. Also, it's in the allele. So A has a particular conformational change that can only be satisfied by a specific conformational change in B. So it's specific to an allele, specific to a mutation in B. It can't be any mutation in B which will satisfy the requirement for binding with A. So the conformational specificity is there at the allele level and at the gene level. A mutation in A can only be suppressed by mutation in B, not by mutation in another gene, because it's only interacting with the product of gene B. The bypass mutations, specific for the gene. So in this case, the gene is, let's take the example again, we're suppressing a GALE mutation. Specifically, mutation in GALK will do that. But any allele, any mutation in GALK will satisfy the requirement for knocking out that pathway and bypassing the defect. So yes, it's specific for the gene, but no, it could be any way of mutating that gene, any allele within a gal A gene would be satisfactory. All right, so let's talk about the different types of phenotypes that you get when you look for mutants. And this gets into a little bit of the area of definition, so we'll go through this very quickly. Auxotrophic mutants are mutants which have specific requirements for growth in defined media. So when we're speaking of auxotrophic mutants, generally we talk about mutants which require vitamins for growth or specific amino acids for growth. And when you grow them on defined minimal salts medium, if you don't supply those nutrients, they won't be able to grow. So again, here you need to know what the original growth requirements for the organism were in the first place. For E. coli, basically, he provided with minimal salts and glucose, it'll grow just in that medium alone because it can supply, it can synthesize all of its vitamins and all of its amino acids. So if you make mutations which alter the ability to synthesize any of those compounds, those are referred to as auxotrophic mutants. Resistant mutants are exactly what they sound like. They're resistant to toxic compounds which would normally kill or inhibit the growth of the organism. And then conditional lethal mutants are the only kind that you can isolate in essential genes. And we talked about this on Tuesday as well. Knocking out a gene that's essential for growth means you can't recover the mutant. So the only way to do that is to recover mutants which are conditionally lethal. That is, they will grow under permissive conditions, but will fail to grow under non-permissive conditions. And that's the nature of a conditional mutant allele. The restrictive conditions are those growth conditions where the mutant phenotype is manifested. So we're talking about a temperature-sensitive mutation. At high growth temperatures, that mutant phenotype will be shown. The organism can't grow. At a lower temperature, in this case, we call that the permissive condition. The wild-type phenotype is shown, and the organism will be able to grow. So those are conditional lethal mutations. You can also have conditional mutations for genes which are not essential. It's basically the same definition. Under permissive conditions, you get expression of the phenotype, active protein. Under the restrictive condition, either the protein is inactive or is not expressed or is truncated or there's some other defect so that the phenotype is the null phenotype. Now, another way of dealing with essential genes is to make mutations that can be complemented in trans. So when you make a knockout of the gene in the genome, but you have complementation of that gene on a plasmid under a regulated promoter, then you can show basically that it's an essential gene by altering the expression of that gene that's expressed in trans on the plasmid. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in detail at the end of today's talk, perhaps some time. Now, dominant negative mutations are really important. And these have been used not just in bacterial genetics, but they're used a lot in eukaryotic genetics, yeast genetics, they're used in mammalian genetics. It's really a very powerful tool. And basically what it is are mutations that encode mutant polypeptides that when you overexpress them, they disrupt the activity of the wild-type gene. So that's what we call a dominant negative effect. The mutant allele, the mutant phenotype, is going to be dominant to the wild-type phenotype. And this can happen by interference with monomeric proteins as well as interference with multimeric proteins. And the way this works is shown on this slide for the monomeric proteins. So here's your wild-type protein. And it has an active binding site where it's going to bind the substrate. And it binds that substrate, and in this case, it will phosphorylate the substrate and release the phosphorylated product. Very simple reaction, right? You can get a mutation in that polypeptide, which now will allow the enzyme to bind the substrate but not phosphorylate it and not release it. Okay, so that's the mutant phenotype here. This can be a dominant negative phenotype if when that particular polypeptide is expressed in excess, it will be binding the substrate so that the wild type enzyme can't bind any substrate. There's no substrate available. Basically, the mutant enzyme, the mutant protein, has titrated out the substrate so that there are no substrate, there's no substrate available for the wild-type protein to interact. So this is where you have a dominant negative effect. So the negative phenotype is dominant when it's overexpressed. So excess mutant will trump the wild-type enzyme. Now, the dominant negative interference with a multimeric protein maybe is intuitively a little bit easier to understand. Let's take the example of an enzyme which is active in its multimeric state. So you have monomers which are present that need to interact, and let's say for the sake of argument, they interact through the N-terminal end is the interactive domain binding site, so that's how you form your multimers, and this is the active form of the protein. So you can get a derivative or a mutant number one, which only makes the N-terminal end of the protein. And that has the protein-protein binding domain. So when that mutant protein is produced in excess over the wild type, then there's less of a possibility that the complete polypeptide, the wild type protein, will be able to find a binding partner and interact because there's an excess of the mutant protein, which doesn't have the carboxy terminal domain, but does have the protein-protein interactive domain. So you get many more of these molecules forming than multimers which have the active enzymatic activity. So in this case, it's dominant negative because, again, you're titrating out the wild-type product with this derivative number one, which will allow it to interact with the intact monomers, the complete monomers, such that the complete monomers can't find another complete monomer to interact with, and thus you don't have activity. And a similar thing can happen here with mutant 3, or derivative 3 as it's called, where they still interact with each other, but mutant 3 has a defect in the in one of the domains such that it has no activity. So that when it does interact with the normal monomers here, it knocks out the activity. So this doesn't have activity as a complete intact protein. So this is a way where you get dominant negative interference by producing a protein which is basically going to titer out the good molecules and render them inactive. Now, the synthetic phenotype is a phenotype that is probably used more frequently in yeast genetics, and Teresa Dunn will talk a little bit more about this when she talks to you about yeast genetics. And this is a phenotype that's created by the alleles of two different genes in combination. Neither one of them alone will give you that phenotype. So it's a contribution of the mutant phenotype of both of those alleles. And often, the phenotype is a lethal phenotype. That's one of the most powerful usages of synthetic phenotypes is to make synthetic lethals, where you can have two different genes which alone have no effect on growth of the organism, but in combination, those mutations in combination are lethal for the organism. So again, single mutation in either of two alleles alone is not lethal. Mutation in both alleles is lethal. So XY stand alone, organisms are viable, they can grow. If they're mixed together, the combination is lethal for the organism. This suggests that the function encoded by X and Y may be essential functions, and that if you inactivate one of them, the other can complement that function because they're functionally redundant. So X and Y may be essential to growth of the organism, but they carry out analogous or redundant functions so that inactivating one doesn't kill the organism because the other one is still functioning. It's only when you put mutations in both of those genes in the same organism that you knock out the functional redundancy and thus leads to the lethal phenotype. So those are synthetic lethals, and we won't talk any more about them. I won't talk about bacteria because, again, more frequently used in yeast genetics. So let's then talk about mutations. To paraphrase a very popular phrase, mutations happen, just like stuff happens in life. It's a fact of life. It's probably one of the stronger driving forces in evolution as well. And it happens in E. coli at a frequency of 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 8. So if you wanted to make mutations in a particular gene, if you wanted to select spontaneous mutations, you can do it because it happens frequently enough and you can grow bacteria rapidly enough to get high enough densities that you can achieve the numbers needed to see these relatively rare 1 in a million, 1 in 100 million events. And spontaneous mutations generally are insertions or deletions, and they arise because of, among other things, mistakes in replication. Nothing's perfect in life. I hope I'm not the first person to tell you that. But things happen when you try to replicate DNA. And if you think about the speed that polymerases run along these templates in generating copies of DNA, it's amazing that the mistakes will happen more often. But mistakes do happen, and you can actually calculate the number of mistakes. So the correct base selection by the major DNA polymerase free coli has an error frequency of 10 to the minus 4 per base pair for self-generation. So it makes mistakes. It's going to happen. And actually, this is a relatively high number. So why don't we see mutations happen more frequently in these organisms? Why don't we see mutations all the time? The polymerase, while it's very rapid at synthesizing the DNA, and it does make mistakes, also has attached to it proofreading enzymes, which enable it to go backwards in a 3' to 5' exonuclease fashion to cut out mistakes that were made. So if the wrong base was incorporated, the DNA polymerase proofreading machinery can actually scan back and they'll digest what has been synthesized so that now the polymerase can take another shot at getting it right the next time through. And this reduces the error rate several orders of magnitude now. So it's getting a little bit better. So the fidelity is a little bit more improved as a result of this proofreading activity of the DNA polymerase. Above and beyond the proofreading machinery, there is a mismatch repair machinery in E. coli. And what this does is it recognizes mismatched bases in the newly synthesized templates. And it will allow the organism now to check for these mismatched bases that have escaped the proofreading, because again, I said, nothing's perfect. So the polymerase, an imperfect polymerase is helped out by an imperfect proofreading mechanism, and those together increase the fidelity several orders of magnitude. And finally, the mismatch repair machine will catch the mistakes that were not caught by the proofreaders. And they'll remove the mismatches and increase the fidelity, again, a couple orders of magnitude. So induced mutations, then, are really what we use as geneticists, because you can increase the frequency of mutation by inducing mistakes. If you wait for mistakes to happen, as we saw with E. coli, they happen, but it's still relatively rare. So you can put the numbers in your favor by generating mutations. And actually, the mutations that you get when you induce mutations are going to be qualitatively different from the spontaneous mutations. You can get point mutations, whereas with the spontaneous mutations, you tend to get insertions and deletions. And the different classes of mutagens that you can use to manipulate the organism can either act at the replication step, or they can act directly on the DNA. And these have different outcomes. So at the replication step, you can trick the DNA replication machinery into inserting the wrong base. Or you can act directly on the DNA and change the DNA template so that the DNA replication machinery will read something that's not supposed to be there because you altered the template. So changing the template changes the consequence of DNA replication. So let's talk about the different types of mutagenic agents. And again, some of this will be reviewed for MedMicro. So you have your physical agents, like irradiation, UV or X-ray, chemical agents such as base analogs, DNA reactive or modifying agents, and then biological agents such as mutator strains and transposable elements. And we'll go through all these different classes briefly. So UV damage generated by UV light is in the form of pyrimidine dimers. These pyrimidine dimers basically act as roadblocks for the replication machinery. You can't get through. And these can be lethal to the bacteria. And these again happen by generating the cyclobutane rings among adjacent thymidine. Chemical mutagens include base analogs such as 2-aminopurine, 5-bromouracil, DNA reactive or modifying agents. So these base analogs are molecules that look like the right bases that should be inserted in the DNA. The DNA modifying agents are chemicals that are going to alter the DNA, physically alter the DNA, either by deaminating them or alkylating the bases. And then you have intercalating agents, which are dyes, such as ethidine bromide and aconite, which physically insert in being a duplex and alter the turns of the double helix so that the replication machinery makes mistakes as it goes through. So the base analogs, such as 2-aminopurine, when they get inserted, they will actually pair with the wrong base the next round of replication. So you have 2-aminopurine, which gets inserted, it will now base pair with thymine. And its protonated state, it can base pair with cytosine. So you, instead of getting an AT base pair occurring, you get the protonated 2-aminopurine base pairing with cytosine. So the DNA replication is going to be altered there because of the base pairing differences. So that's how you alter the and cause mutations by inserting an analog of the correct base. In situ, the bases can also undergo chemical changes. So in situ, cytosine can be deaminated and it will become uracil. And obviously uracil isn't going to base pair at the next round of replication with guanosine, which is what cytosine normally base pair with. It's going to go with adenine. So you get an alteration in the next round of replication because you've deaminated this base to a different base. Similarly, if you take 5-methylcytosine deaminated, it becomes thymine, and again, the base pairing at the next round of replication is going to be different. And it's how you get a mutation at that site in the DNA. Alkylation occurs in a similar fashion as deamination. It's just a different chemical process. So here, the commonly used EMS, ethyl methane sulfonate, is a mutagen, which will deaminate guanine to ethyl guanine. And again, the base pairing is different. It's not GC, it becomes ethyl guanine with thymine. So it's a GC to an 18 mutation. Similarly, EMS will alkylate thymine and get an alteration from a TA base pairing to a GC base pairing. So this is just another example of chemical modification which alters the base pairing and gives you point mutations. And the intercalating agents we talked about again in MedMicro, these are planar dyes which will insert in the double helix of the DNA and alter the twist so that either it alters the replication of plasmids so that they fail to replicate, and that leads to plasmid curing, which is loss of the plasmid from daughter cells, or insertions and deletions as a result of the DNA replication machinery jumping over these stretches called the altered double helix. Now, the genetic or biological mutators are strains of bacteria. In this case, we're talking about E. coli. These are strains of bacteria that have a higher than normal rate of spontaneous mutation. And this is because of mutations in genes which are normally involved in maintaining a higher rate of proofreading and correction of mistakes in DNA replication. So those genes I told you about that are involved in the proofreading or the mismatch repair machinery for DNA replication, if they're mutated, then obviously you lose either proofreading activity, such as with the D genes, or mutations in HLS or U, which are involved in methyl-directed repair. If you knock out one of these genes, you alter the ability of the bacteria to repair some of these mistakes in DNA replication. Thus, those strains have a high rate of spontaneous mutations. We call them mutator strains. Genes in those strains have a tendency to have a higher rate of spontaneous mutation because the bacteria can't fix the mistakes that normally happen in DNA replication. So that's an example of biological mutators. Transposable elements, which we talked about in MedMicro, we'll speak about a little bit in the next couple of weeks, are pieces of DNA which can physically insert into different regions in the genome. And in doing so, they can inactivate genes. So these are, again, an example of a genetic mutator. When you have a transposable element or an insertion sequence that can physically go into another gene and interrupt its coding sequence, you've inactivated the function of that gene. And thus, these can be used as mutator tools. So let's just go over very briefly the model for mismatch repair in E. coli. Be sure you understand how this works. You'll see, again, how mutations in this machinery lead to a higher rate of spontaneous mutation. So mismatch repair is a way that the bacteria can find kinks in the DNA where the bases don't line up because the base pairing has been altered. So here is shown as a little peak in the line. So the double helix is altered here. The bases don't align. They don't base pair. The MUTE-S protein is a protein that's part of this mismatch repair machinery that scans along the DNA and looks for the misalignment of the bases. It looks for where the base pairing is altered because of the wrong base being inserted there. When that happens, it mobilizes the other proteins in the complex, MUTE-L and MUTE-S, and these proteins will scan along until they find a sequence in the DNA that's hemimethylated. If you remember from Ed Michael, we talked about the problem in mismatch repair is to figure out which of the two bases that don't match up here is the wrong base, because there's no way of telling. They don't match up to each other, but you can't say whether the mistake was in inserting the base on this strand or this strand. And the way the bacteria can tell is it scans along the newly synthesized DNA until it comes to a hemimethylated site. So you can see that on one strand of the DNA, the template strand, the DNA is methylated. On the other strand, the newly synthesized strand, it's not methylated. That becomes methylated later as the enzymes can accumulate to methylate. So here at this hemimethylated site, the MUTE-H and MUTE-L proteins can detect which of the two strands is the template strand by looking for the strand that's methylated. And that's how it tells MUTE-S which strand to be cutting and where to start the single-stranded digest, which will remove this wrong base. And then there'll be repair enzymes that come in here that will fill in this gap. It's called gap repair. It involves DNA polymerases that will now use this template strand to synthesize and fill in the gap. And it knows it's using the right strand because that was the methylated strand, and that's how you can tell what's the original template strand. So that's mismatch repair in E. coli. Now, going back to how some of the other defects are fixed, photoreactivation is a way that the bacteria can remove thionine dimers. This involves an enzyme which is photoactivated that will physically cut out the thionine dimer, and it'll leave a small gap that will be repaired and ligated and filled in. So this is distinct from a more comprehensive type of repair mechanism that will remove these dimers, which is called excision repair. And this is analogous to what we saw with the mismatch repair machine. What happens here is the thymine dimers are detected by the excision repair machinery, and a large nick will be cut into the DNA strand flanking the thymine dimer. So unlike the photoreactivation repair, the dimer itself is not just cleaved out, but a larger stretch of DNA is nicked, and then that is filled in with the excision repair enzymes. So it's a larger piece of DNA that's excised, and then it's filled in with these enzymes, and that's what excision repair is. Yeah?
Which one's more common, say, for photoreactivation or excision repair?
Which one's more common? Excision repair will happen even in the dark. Photoreactivation requires light activation in order for it to happen. The SOS response is also a way that you can get mutations. If any of you have read ahead in the book, you'll know that the SOS response is a regulon of genes which respond to stress in the bacteria. And it involves a coordinated response of the RecA protein sensing DNA damage in the organism. So under normal conditions, LexA is a repressor which in its dimeric form will repress synthesis of certain of these repair enzymes that are involved in the response to DNA damage, which is called the SOS response. RecA, which is normally made, of course, as part of the recombination proteins, is also an enzyme which will detect single-stranded DNA. And when bacteria are exposed to stress that generates single-stranded DNA damage, that will activate RecA so that it now will activate the autocatalytic, autoproteolytic process of Lex A so that Lex A cleaves itself. And when the dimeric Lex A cleaves itself, the repressor falls apart and can no longer bind to the promoters of these different genes in the SOS response. So the net consequence of that is that these genes are now turned on. So that's what the SOS response is. It's the activation of this constellation of genes which respond to DNA damage. And one of the things that happens that's made is that the one of the genes which is synthesized or which is expressed under these conditions is a error-prone polymerase. It's the product of the UMUD gene. So that gets turned on, and this error-prone polymerase is capable of replicating or synthesizing DNA over thymidine dimers. So in response to DNA damage, which is causing thymidine dimers, this is one of the enzymes which is important to have so that the bacteria can continue to replicate its DNA and hop over these thymidine dimers. Otherwise, it's a lethal stage for the bacteria. The reason why SOS response is mutagenic is because the trade-off is this polymerase is prone to errors. It sticks in the wrong bases. So an SOS response will save the bacteria, but at a price. You get generation of mutations in some genes because this error-prone polymerase is activated and starts repairing the DNA damage from UD light, for example, but at a cost of having a certain number of mutations occur in the organism as well. So that's why we can refer to this as the SOS mutagenesis as well, because it's the SOS response that leads to increasing mutations in the organism. So, mutations are good. Mutations are good because it's a driving force of evolution, and mutations are good because as geneticist Salvador Luria told us that when you have a mutant, you're better off than when you don't. And it's absolutely correct. A good colleague of mine who I went to graduate school with, Bill Jacobs, likes to talk about bacterial genetics being like New York City, which is where Bill works. He actually works in the Bronx. Anything that can happen will happen, all at an observed frequency. So in bacteria, because you can get those numbers, you can see what you're looking for if you have a way of detecting it. If it can happen, it will happen. And your job as a geneticist is to find those events. So it's a numbers game. It all comes down to numbers. And Bill likes to talk about how to control things so that you win and you play the genetic lottery. So what you want to do is, if you want to make mutants, you need to mutagenize to get the numbers up. Remember we talked about spontaneous mutations being a relatively low frequency. It's a relatively low rate. So if you want to get mutants, you probably want to mutagenize the organism rather than wait for things to happen. This puts the numbers in your favor. But you need to know how much to mutagenize. Too much of a good thing is not a good thing. You have to strike a balance between having too few mutants, which means that you have to screen, score through a whole lot of different possible variants, or getting too much killing. So if you think that a particular agent, like any of these mutagenic agents we talked about, are good at generating mutations, and you want to just add a lot of it, you really need to strike this balance because you can kill all the bacteria. Even worse, what's worse than killing all the bacteria? Even worse is you can generate multiple mutational events. And that is the equivalent of the genetic nightmare. So if you over-mutagenize the population and you find a mutant that you're interested in studying, if you over-mutagenize it and you've got multiple mutational events in that organism, it's going to be real hard to find out which of the mutations is responsible for the phenotype you're interested in studying. So you have to strike a balance. And this is just an example of a couple of curves that you can do on your own to measure the percent survival of the population relative to the time of treatment with any given mutagen. So this is showing a couple of experiments where you're just plotting survival versus amount of time exposure to the mutagen. And what you'd like to strive for is something that's giving you about 99.1 or 99.99% survival. You don't want to get too much killing, otherwise you're not going to be able to figure out where the mutations are. So if you take the survival curves and then plot that against an experiment where you look at the frequency of spontaneous, I'm sorry, it's a frequency mutation to rifampin resistance. This is what you get using the curves that we see here. Final treatment with an NMG and the frequency of rif-resistant mutants. So rif-mutants map to which gene? Anybody remember? Rifampicin resistance?
Plasmid?
No, not plasmid. Rif resistance. Rifampicin is an antibiotic. We all know that. Beta subunit of the polymerase. Go on, Shannon. 66%.
It does target the beta subunit
of
the RNA
polymerase. RNA polymerase, yeah. You got all those little things, right? So these mutations map to RPOB, RNA polymerase subunit B. So that makes sense. Here you can see that based on the amount of time exposed to the drug, to the mutagen, you reach a maximum number of mutants and it kind of plateaus. So if you do this type of a preliminary experiment, you can figure out how much time you want to expose your organism to the mutagen to optimize the amount of mutants that you're going to get before you get into the point of no return, where you're going to end up probably getting multiple mutations, not any more additional mutations that are just rich than mutant. Now, a couple of concepts you need to keep in mind when you're doing mutant isolation is that there are lag times, such as phenotypic lag and genotypic lag. The phenotypic lag is when you have a mutation which knocks out a gene, and then before you actually see the phenotype of that mutation, you need to grow up the bacteria. And the reason for that can be shown here. Let's say that you're looking at a gene which is making these starred compounds. So in the wild-type organism, you've got those starred compounds present in the cytoplasm. You make the mutation, or the mutation occurs, now you can no longer make that protein. At the first division of that mutated organism, the daughter cells separate and they divide the cytoplasmic contents as well as the genomic contents. So the cytoplasmic contents still maintain some copies of the original wild-type protein. So this organism still expressing a wild-type phenotype. Next cell division, you still are diluting out the cytoplasmic contents and thus diluting out the remaining copies of that wild-type protein until you get to this division where you now have bacteria that don't have any of that protein at all. And those are the bacteria which will start manifesting the mutant phenotype. In these earlier stages, they don't manifest that phenotype. It's not until you get here where you've diluted out the copies of that protein where you now get the mutant phenotype. Okay? That's what we refer to as phenotypic lag. Now, segregation lag is analogous, but what this means is you need to wait for the genomes to segregate out until you get a homogeneous population of the mutant genome. So here I'm showing you an example of an organism that has four copies of the genome in it. And I show you this because in principle, in an exponentially growing culture of E. coli, you get multiple copies of the chromosome. That doesn't mean that the organism is diploid, still a haploid organism. It's just that the DNA needs to replicate with multiple replication forks in order to keep up with the rapid division time at the level of cell division. So you get, effectively, four copies of a certain number of genes in the organism. So let's say you made a mutation in one of those copies. Again, at the cell division, those are going to be segregated out. And it's not until you get further along with each subsequent cell division that you've segregated out the wild-type copies of the genome from the mutant copies of the genome. So you get an organism which is homogeneous for the mutant genotype. That's what segregation lag is, allowing for time for these things to segregate out. This is basically showing the same thing. Now, what are the kinds of tools that you need to have at your disposal in order to win the genetic lottery? You can do a couple of things. Selection and counter-selection is the best if you can do it. So what is selection? Selection is using growth conditions, either biological, chemical treatments, to favor or to enrich a population that you're interested in isolating. So within a population of bacteria, if you're looking for a particular mutant, you would like to be able to select for that subpopulation of bacteria, because remember, they're going to be rare in the population. These are the mutants. These are the ones that are going to be rare in that population. And what you can do is, for example, select for reversion of an auxotrophic mutant to a phototrophic mutant. That can be done in a very straightforward fashion. So let's say you start out with a mutant that cannot synthesize histidine. How do you select for mutants that are revertants now that can synthesize histidine? Those would be your phototrophic strains, right? How do you do that? If you want to select for revertants. What's that? Just grow them on medium with?
Histidine.
Grow them on medium with histidine?
If they need to survive.
Right. So then where are you going to grow them on what kind of medium?
Without
histidine.
Yeah.
Right. So you grow them on minimal medium without histidine. The auxotrophs die. The phototrophs, those mutants, which now have restored the ability to synthesize histidine, grow. You can select for those. So in a population of 10 to the 8 bacteria, there may be 10 which have reverted or mutated the prototrope. How do you find those 10 out of those 100 million? You can select that directly. Going the opposite way, not so easy. We'll talk about how you can do that in the next slide. Similarly, you can select the resistances very easily because the selected pressure is to kill the sensitive organisms. So selection for resistance to antibiotics. Just plate them on plates with the antibiotic. Any of the organisms which are sensitive, you're going to die. Yeah?
When you're selecting for these resistances, are you going to see the lab?
That depends on the mechanism and it depends on when you plate them out. So if you do the mutagenesis and you allow for expression of that phenotype, you can plate them directly. Because you're taking into consideration that the sensitivity needs to be limited out. Okay? So in some cases, yes, the targets for these antibiotics may still be present in the organism, and some of these mutations to resistance are recessive to the wild-type sensitivity. Okay? Example of streptomycin resistance, chromosomal streptomycin resistance. So if you have a mutant allele which is making the ribosomes that are resistant to the streptomycin, and in the same organism you have the allele that's sensitive, making the ribosomes that are sensitive, the sensitivity phenotype is dominant for the resistance. So you need to wait for the phenotypic lag to occur in order to dilute out those ribosomes which are sensitive in order to see the resistant phenotype. Phages can be used to select for mutants as well. Phage resistance, phage sensitivity, can do selection. Working with bacteria means working with large populations. So if you want to look for that one in 100 million, you'd like to be able to do selection for those mutants. Now, you can do forward selection and reverse selection. And this can be done in a couple of instances here. So forward selection allows you to grow the organism and look for loss of a particular function. This is a loss of function mutant. Example, you can select for resistance to phage T1. This results in loss of a receptor for the phage. So that's a forward mutation to loss of function. Resistance to an antibiotic, giving you an altered target. It's a forward selection. The reverse selection allows growth of the revertants in which a particular gene function is restored. So that would be looking for the revertants of a particular defect. So you can go forward, you can go reverse in your selection. Special case of reverse and forward selection are the case of tetracycline resistance and lambda sensitivity. So the TET resistance genes, encoded by TET-AR, leads to an altered membrane permeability because TET resistance is imparted by a membrane localized pump. And this pump, which interferes with penetration of tetracycline, makes the organism resistant to tetracycline at a cost. That particular bacterium now, which is resistant to tetracycline, also becomes sensitive to certain other compounds. which are chelators, such as fusaric acid. So this allows you to do forward and reverse selection. So with the tetracycline resistance gene present, you can now select for those strains that are tet resistant. If you want to look for loss of this particular gene, you can select for resistance to fusaric acid. And those strains which are resistant now to this compound have become resistant because they've lost the function of the tet genes. So you can select in one direction with this allele, you can select in another direction as well. Similarly, with the LANB protein, which is responsible for maltose transport, this protein is also the receptor for bacteriophage lambda. So you can select for resistance to lambda infection, and what you'll get are strains which are no longer able to transport maltose. So the resistance comes at a cost. You can then look for mutants which are able to grow on maltodextrins, and those will be revertants of the LANB mutation. So you can select in either direction. You can select for inactivation of LANB by selecting for resistance to the infection of bacteriophage lambda. You can select for restoration of LANB function by asking the bacteria to grow on minimal medium with maltodextrins as a carbon source. They can go in either direction with these particular loops. Yeah.
So selecting for these mutants, it's not so much a mutant for some people, but there's another underlying mutation that you're interested in.
This is just to show you as a principle, the tools that you can go in either direction when you're selecting for certain alleles. So for certain resistances like to bacteriophage T1, you would look for loss of function of that receptor. So it goes in one direction, you add the phage, you get loss of function of that. And that's one direction. Here, since we know that the lambda receptor also serves this other function, you can take advantage of that and go in either direction. So you can get lambda resistance, loss of function of the maltose transport, and then you can look for lambda sensitivity. But you can't select for that by using lambda, can you? Because if you add phage, it kills it. If you're asking for, give me bacteria which are sensitive to lambda. Which basically what you're asking for are mutants which are going to be susceptible to the toxic agent, the killing agent, the selective agent. You can't recover them. But you can recover them if you ask for expression of this phenotype of the same gene, which is ability to grow on minimal maltose as a carbon source. So you can go in both directions with this particular allele. Similarly with the TET gene. So these are special cases where a single gene gives you a phenotype that you can select in one direction or the other. And that's why these are special cases. But conceptually, I want you to understand that because these can also be used as tools for doing selection for genetic markers when you're doing strain constructions. But also understanding the concept about how you can go in one or the other direction based on the phenotypes that are imparted to these particular genes.
So all the ones that grow with the maltodextrins are all sensitive to the infection by the phage?
Yeah, if you can restore the ability to transport maltose, then you restore the ability of the phage to bind to the transport protein. Okay, so what you need to keep, and this was something that my PhD mentor was fond of telling us all the time, is that you always get what you select for. It might not be what you want, but you're always going to get. So be careful when you're doing selections and you're setting up your selective conditions because you'll get anything that's going to survive the selection. If you haven't thought through what the particular types of mutants can be that will survive that selection, you may get some surprises. So you may say that, okay, if I'm going to apply this particular selective condition, the only organisms that are going to survive it will be these types of mutants. You've got to think through and be sure that those are the only mutants you're going to get it. Because you may get a different population of mutants that are totally unrelated to what you're hoping for because there's another way of allowing the bacteria to survive the selection. So it all depends on choosing your selective conditions. You've got to know and have thought through all the different consequences. So that being said, selection really is the way you want to go when you make mutants. Because it's direct. Bacteria do all the work. And as a geneticist, let me tell you, we are lazy people. by design. If we can get the bacteria to do all the work, that's the way we're going to design the experiment. So if you can design an experiment where you can select for the mutants that you want, bacteria can do all the work for you. Either they're going to grow or they're not going to grow. Unfortunately, that's not always the way things happen. There'll be lots of times when you cannot directly select for the mutation that you're interested in. And in that case, you have to screen for the mutation. What that means is that every member of the population has to be examined for the desired phenotype. That's not the best of all worlds, particularly if you're talking about mutation frequencies that are in the order of 1 in a million and 1 in 10 to the million, 1 in 10 million, or 100 million. You don't want to have to go in and screen every single one of those 100 million bacteria to find the mutant you're interested in. So what can you do? Different strategies include, obviously, mutagenizing to increase the mutation frequency, get your numbers up, using indicator media when you can. So there are different types of media that will give you color changes based on pH changes. So for example, Meconchi agar can be used with different sugars to look for organisms which are altered in fermentation properties, their ability to use different sugars. Fermenters will make red colonies on these type of indicator plates. Non-fermenters will make white colonies. So you can do a screening where all the bacteria grow, and you tell the different phenotypes from the mutant and the wild type by looking for the color of the colony. Similarly, tetrazolium agar also has a pH indicator in it, which gives you the reverse color change. So fermenters on tetrazolium give white colonies, non-fermenters give red colonies. And then there are the colorimetric substrates such as XGAL, which we talked about on Tuesday, which start out with a colorless compound, which when cleaved by a particular enzyme, give you a blue compound, which then stains the colony blue, and you can look easily for mutants in a population of organisms which have that particular trait by looking for the ones which now don't cleave the compound and give you white colonies. So these colorimetric substrates exist for beta-galactosidase, and then there are XP compounds, which are substrates for phosphatases. So you can use this as a screen for mutants which are altered in the production of different phosphatases, because they will make white colonies rather than blue colonies. And then replica plating is another way for screening large numbers of bacterial colonies for different phenotypes. So this slide just gives you an example of what we're talking about with the Meconchi plates. Again, red colonies, these are fermenters, white colonies, non-fermenters. Tetrazolium is the reverse. White colonies are the fermenters, red are the non-fermenters. And replica plating is a way of screening hundreds of bacteria in a relatively short period of time. So take the example that we talked about earlier, where you're looking for mutants that fail to synthesize the enzyme for a particular amino acid. Go back to histidine. We talked about how you can get reverkins by plating on a minimal medium, but getting those mutants in the first place, you can't select for them. How do you select for something which fails to grow on minimal medium that doesn't have histidine in it? By definition, you can't. Because it doesn't have histidine, you can't make it, it can't grow. So how do you screen for those mutants? You do that by replica plating. So replica plating means starting out with your mutant population of bacteria that's on a master plate. And the master plate has complete medium that supports the growth of all the bacteria, especially your mutants. So you want the mutants to grow on the master plate. Then you take sterile velveteen that's attached to this plate, this block. And the original blocks are actually automobile engine pistons. And you use this velvet surface, so this velveteen surface, which is a sterile surface, and you press it down on the colonies that are on the master plate. So that now you've got an imprint of those colonies on the sterile surface. And then you transfer those colonies, basically, literally transferring those colonies to additional plates. So the first plate that you transfer it to will be the minimal medium that does not have the amino acid that's needed in your mutants. And then you, again, press the replicate to a second plate, which is your complete medium. So then you incubate these plates, and you ask which colonies are growing. And what you'll be looking for are colonies that grow on the replicate, which is the complete medium, but don't grow on the medium that doesn't have histidine added to it. So this is how you can score and screen for several thousands of meters by replica plating and then looking for the ones which fail to grow by making replicates of them on medium that will support their growth and looking back at the other medium that doesn't support the growth and identifying the mutants in that sense. So you can go back to your replicate or go back to your master template and pull up the mutants there. So that's how replica plating can be used to screen for large numbers of mutants. Basically, this is what I showed here now. From a library plate to a minimal without histidine, onto a minimal with histidine, and then comparing for where the bacterial colonies grow. And this is your result. So replica plating helps you get around the problem of screening large numbers, but you still need to screen large numbers. It just makes it a little bit easier for you to do that. Okay? All right, so I'm going to leave it at this point now and pick up the rest of the discussion about mutants and mutant analysis next Tuesday, and then we'll get into gene transfer, which is the topic for Tuesday. I don't want to keep you any longer. We're already a little bit over time, but there are a couple other things I want to talk about in terms of mutant analysis. We'll cover that on Tuesday. Anybody have any questions on the material we talked about today? Good? Okay. All right, I'll see you on Tuesday.